when Trump was announcing the tariffs on Canada, and it went right to the line on the Monday, and then a negotiated deal was done. If you had called your advisor and said, I want to rebalance and get out of all my Canadian stocks and get some of my Canadian assets and go into U.S. stocks and U.S. Dollar exposures, you would have actually lost money in that trade. I'm saying that because there are people who, wanted to do that. And so the reality is that that's an emotional decision. That's a reaction. And what the markets don't, I love to always state, it's a long term, it is really about, are you directionally doing the things that, are the right motions to earn the right returns from profits and all the rest of it as a business or as an asset? And fundamentally, that's what you really should be focused on. Has something changed structurally? And if it has, what do I need to do? And you need to be precise about those things. Advisors today really need to be focused on kind of going to first principles, thinking about how's my portfolio structured? Am I in the right place for this new regime? Because it was ultimately what should have been happening over the last, 60, 90, 100 days in preparation for a 4-year period that could be very different than the last 4-year period.
Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. Saum Saif, CEO at Purpose Investments, joins us to debunk the greatest myths about private investing and to talk about why it might just be one of the smart moves for your portfolio right now.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Saum, welcome. It is great to have you back. How are you doing?
I'm well, Pierre. And, things have, of course, started off, January 2025. And we've had a, noisy and crazy year already. A lot happened in a very few weeks. And I'm excited to see what can happen over the next 10, 12 months here. So, we've got a lot of unpredictable areas of the markets and economy that we have to fight through. But ultimately, I think staying steady, focused, and is the right thing to do right now.
Yeah, I mean, we've had what do we have? We've had like 3 years of news in 3 weeks, right?
That's right.
So, Saum, to begin, what are your thoughts on this unusual period that we're in?
Look, at the end of the day, every period is unusual, if you put it that way. If you think about as an investor, as I said, it's a very noisy time right now.
Yeah.
It's both emotional, wherever you sit on and land on the position of, you're really excited about the work that's happening in the United States or you're upset with it. It doesn't matter. It was going to be emotional. Whoever the leader was in the United States. I think what matters really is, as an investor, one of the things that you should be paying attention to, as we always say, is like, this is a time to make sure always that you don't let the noise, the unpredictability of things that are happening around you, ultimately kind of make you react or be nervous. In fact, it's all about, being consistent and strong. And I say that not because I'm saying, hey, put your head in the sand and go away. It's like making sure that you think about, what is the next 4 years going to look like? What are the policies that ultimately are being implemented? And by the way, this is the same under any, new leader, is what change are they going to make? And are my position or the businesses that I'm positioned in, going to ultimately be able to earn greater profits, to generate, better growth or worse growth? And if, am I positioned for that? And if the answer is yes, and the reality is most likely in many cases it is, then you're probably pretty good on your asset mix and all the rest. But there are going to be areas of the, of investing that are going to be impacted negatively, and that might have been already happening.
Yeah.
And it's just maybe accelerates it. And there'll be two ways to think about that. Some that will be a slow grind. It's just, structural change that's happening, different tax, different models of economic activity, all the rest of it. Or it could be a moment in time, like, a tariff was put in the auto sector and it has a real impact immediately on that sector. And so you just have to be positioned and make sure is my portfolio positioned for the long-term success of the businesses and the assets that I own? Or is there actual, am I in the wrong trends?
You could be sitting around, for example, thinking like we're in this period, looks like a crisis or it feels like a crisis because it's the something, some elements of it are so chaotic. But, you know, the flip side of that is that every crisis foments opportunity as well, right? You know, the old Chinese proverb, crisis equals opportunity. I mean, I'm simplifying it, but, you know, the key is obviously, as you say, is to be positioned so that, you know, you're not caught on the back foot as opposed to, for example, you know, what some people think is the most defensive position is to reduce, you know, risk, reduce exposure to risk.
Well, I mean, a great example would be, look, emotions are high always in these moments. And I believe that you've got to be unemotional as an investor. You got to really take the emotions out of it. It doesn't mean you have to take your values out of it, but just you have to take your emotions out of it. And I'll give you an example. If, you know, when Trump was announcing the tariffs on Canada and it went right to the line on the Monday, you know, and then negotiated deal was done. If you had called your advisor and said, I want to rebalance and get out of all my Canadian stocks and get some of my Canadian assets and go into U.S. stocks and U.S. Dollar exposures, you would have actually lost money in that trade.
And yeah, exactly. The TSX and was
all decision, right? Yeah. And so that, and by the way, I'm saying that because there are people who, you know, wanted to do that. Yeah. And so the reality is that that's an emotional decision. That's a reaction. And what the markets don't, you know, I love to always state, you know, it's a long-term, you know, it is really about, are you directionally doing the things that, you know, are the right motions to earn the right returns from profits and all the rest of it as a business or as an asset? And fundamentally, that's what you really should be focused on. Has something changed structurally? And if it has, what do I need to do? And you need to be precise about those things. Yeah. And, you know, advisors today really need to be focused on kind of going to first principles, thinking about how's my portfolio structured? Am I in the right place for this new regime? Because it was ultimately what should have been happening over the last, you know, 60, 90, 100 days in preparation for a four-year period that could be very different than the last four-year period. And that's what we should care about more than anything else. And more often than not, the changes that people make are very minimal. They're on the edges of the portfolio for the long run, as opposed to dramatic. And when you find yourself making dramatic changes, oftentimes you're actually letting human emotions get in the middle of something.
Well, and the idea that we can make these, you know, make decisions about a specific direction is really unreliable. I mean, the idea, obviously, when you're putting together your portfolio is to have that situation where, you know, you get your risk going slightly to the left, you know, reducing risk and increasing returns, right? What's interesting and, you know, what's become available over the last decade and on an increasing basis in the last 5 years is this new accessibility to private markets. And that's why I want to talk to you today, because it's really an elegant way, it's an eloquent way of reducing volatility. If you make a lateral move from public equities, publicly traded stocks to private equity, for example, you can take some of that volatility of that day-to-day whim of the market and swings in market valuations. You can move, for example, you can move some of your bond portfolio or fixed income holdings into private credit to also reduce some of those deep market swings that can happen. I mean, we're at this weird time right now, right? With stocks testing new highs. Over a prolonged period, we sort of had some zigzagging going on, volatility in stocks because of the rate environment, because of the monetary environment. I mean, the Fed just paused on cutting. They think that we're at this normalized rate level right now. Given that, it is a perfect time, I think, for us to talk about that. There's a lot of policy uncertainty that we've discussed, and consequently, a lot of opportunity to consider. And there's also, because of the fair amount of economic shifting sands as a result, it is a particularly good time to discuss private markets as a complement and addition to traditional stock bond portfolios.
I would just start with, look, private assets, you know, are a really interesting area that has opened up more broadly for retail investors in the last 5-6 years. And it's a opportunity that, in my opinion, many investors have the ability to take more illiquidity in their portfolios because they're not short term. They're not, you know, trading. You know, they don't need the liquidity of, you know, the cash flow every single day on the 100% of their portfolio. And as a result of that, there are benefits of being in private parts of the market. It doesn't mean that, you know, a portfolio should have 20, 40, 50, 50% right. privates. I mean, unless you are extremely uber rich and you don't need any liquidity at all, you know, that's fine. And you can do that. Even then, in that case, I find that it can be a little bit too much. But there's a reason, you know, for an individual investor, you know, that you know, it's similar to what you're seeing with the large pension funds, which is that they've realized over the last, you know, number of decades that, you know, I don't need to be 100% in the stock market, worrying about movements every single day of the stock prices or the bond market and prices of the bond market and the mark to markets of that. I actually don't need 100% of my capital at any point in time.
Right.
And therefore, I can benefit from longer term thinking. And there's two components that I think private assets provide. One is there can be, and I say this, there can be an illiquidity premium in certain areas. That can come and go. And I would argue that over the long term, like it can be there in certain areas, but you know, you have to be very, very specific. And I wouldn't say that it's necessarily always there, because there are periods when public markets do very well, like we've just come on.
Right.
The second is really the I would argue the ease of not having to worry about day-to-day price fluctuations, even though like the assets themselves, it's like your home. You know, if you actually priced your home every day, there wouldn't be price fluctuations. The reality is that like we don't have to worry about that. We just say we bought a house, we're paying down the mortgage, and ultimately over the long term, you know, my hope is that I make a relatively good return on my
right.
home. But you don't have to worry about like today, did it go up or down? Like, whereas every day, you know, you have a portfolio of stocks that you may not sell for 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 years, but you're watching the stock market and you're kind of feeling good or bad every single day based on how that is. In private assets, it sort of takes that noise away.
Right.
And so the good thing is that you have less of that noise. And in fact, if I go back to our comment about emotions, it actually takes a lot of the emotions out. Like, you know, investing is a long-term game in many ways, and you want to compound over many, many periods over what you're doing, especially in components of your long-term foundational part of your portfolio. And so what private assets can do is allow you to actually kind of put yourself in a box that you can't get emotional,
right.
because it's like you're sort of restricted in the liquidity and you have to think long-term. So those are good things. And that's why, frankly, the big pension funds do it. And it's also why retail, in my opinion, should be doing more of it. But to an extent, and I believe that most retail investors over-optimize to daily liquidity as opposed to incorporating some private assets into their portfolio to just balance out long-term thinking into their models and generate some potentially unique return streams.
Yeah. I mean, historically, ultra high net worth investors, pension funds, and institutions have had access to private equity, private credit, and private real estate. And they're all sectors that have outperformed public markets and with lower volatility historically. Why do you think it might be a good time right now to finally pay attention to this space?
What's happened differently today than it was maybe a decade ago, especially here in Canada, is that, you know, the big pension funds, the big institutional money managers, the ultra high net worth investors had access to some of the best managers in the world. Like they could write the big ticket. They got the attention of the Apollos and the major players out
right.
there who said, like, I want that capital, it's easy. But what's happened in the last 5, 7 years is that they have that group of really high quality investors has actually now recognized the value of getting access to retail investors as well. And what's happened is that retail investors now have access to some of the best money managers in the world. And it's no longer some like, you know, right of way, a right of passage that you have to be big to get it. That allows you to say, I don't have to deal with like the low end, low quality. And in Canada specifically, where we've had really, really low quality, you know, private asset players.
Yeah.
The Bridgings of the world who did the private credit stuff who blew up and was a fraud. You know, some of the private equity players in Canada that have been really, really weak, even the venture firms that have been really weak. There hasn't been this institutional rigor, and retail has been the primary focus because institutions haven't actually been willing to put money in those players.
Right.
Retail has. And now retail, and that has not worked out great for retail investors. What has happened in the last 5, 7, what's changed is retail now has access to the best managers in the world. That's amazing. And it's coming with the ability to do it at lower amounts and smaller tickets. And so you don't have to have $1 million or $500,000 to put into to get your access. So that's a really powerful
and
that's been the shift change that I think is something that's important for retail advisors and investors to be paying attention to.
And I would add, it's pretty safe to say, I would add that retail investors now have a chance to invest alongside the institutions. One of the myths that has been sort of pervasive is the idea that the big guys, you know, the big dogs get all the best deals and the retail market gets the rest, you know, the scraps, right? But that's not the case anymore, right? I mean, the large scale managers are able to integrate retail into the same pool as the big institutions. So you're not getting lower tier deals, for example. It's become very sort of egalitarian.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, the ability to have better structuring, better transparency, and more importantly, invest right alongside, you know, all the other investors at scale. It's a really powerful new change. And for retail investors, it doesn't mean that it's right for everybody, but it means that now the world has changed for them, and we ought to be paying more attention to it. If I go back again 5-10 years ago, there was a lot of terrible product in the Canadian marketplace, and it was because the big guys didn't pay attention. And you know, unfortunately, many Canadians, you know, got scared away whenever they ventured into some of these private credit or private asset businesses, and it didn't work out, or they ended up being a fraud or something like that. That was a functional issue that was really a two-tier market. And now we've got a one-tier market, which is, you know, large investors, small investors all have access to the good stuff.
Lovely. So, Sam, can we talk about how that has been made possible? Like how are the large private shops, the large private money managers making it possible? Like how are they building these instruments to democratize them for investors, and to use that word, to democratize them for investors so that today's retail investors are able to invest alongside institutional investors?
There's still lots of structural things that have to be, you know, get better, and they are getting better. But because, you know, whenever you're dealing with, call it a vehicle that could be theoretically have some liquidity,
right?
With assets that have, you know, long lives to them or have illiquidity to them, there's always some mismatching and stuff like that that has to be managed. But I would start with the fact that the managers themselves have recognized that retail is an important area of focus. And to, you know, in the past, they would have looked at retail and said, I don't want to deal with them. You know, I don't want to have 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 investors in my portfolio and have to deal with the reporting of that. Today, the managers of themselves have realized that it's really actually a great cohort. And if you structure it right with them, that, you know, it's an investment that we have to make to build a rapport and a relationship with them. And I think that's been a huge win. So that shift itself, it wasn't like retail pulling them in.
Right.
It was managers recognizing the value. Second is the structuring. So there's, you know, the way that private assets are generally structured historically are, and it works for institutions well, has been like, you make a commitment up front, they raise a bunch of money, but they don't actually take your money up front. They whenever they make an investment, so like a private equity firm, let's say, raises $100 million, and you know they will go and buy things, and every single time they make an investment, they will do a drawdown of your capital. And so for retail,
right,
that's a really difficult thing, because I what do I have to do? I make a commitment to put money into a fund, but then I don't know when the money's going to be taken from my account. Do I keep that money in cash? Do I kind of keep that money invested? So it's a really difficult thing. But what's happened is, and that works for institutions who have the facilities and structure and movement of assets they can deal with. But for retail, what they've done is they've created these evergreen vehicles, and that's become a real popularization. And what they are is like, they're long life. They don't have a term to them. And they actually have the basket of assets that in them that are already been bought,
right,
and that are continuously with new capital and recycled capital, ultimately buying more. So when the investor comes into it, 100 cents on the dollar is invested day one. So their money is productive right off the bat. And two is, you know, over time, they're buying into a portfolio that's already been in many ways vintage. It has new assets coming in. It has assets that are being sold. And it's really a much better long term. You can actually measure its IRR, its investment return, much more simply,
right,
from the day you invest to the day you, you know, kind of redeem. And so that structuring stuff has become really powerful. And then the third thing is really around reporting and transparency. And so, you know, and managers have become much more focused on being present, providing the right type of depth of information, you know, being open to the fact that they can talk about their portfolio and the assets and the details of what they're doing in much more of an open way. Whereas, you know, in the past, they felt that that was a protective intellectual property. They didn't want to talk about it. And now they feel much more confident. And so that's been really great for retail, because now you have much more insight on what are the strategies? What are they holding? You know, what are my assets doing from a productive perspective? And it's been really great to give comfort as to what ultimately these assets can be.
So much greater transparency.
100%. Yeah. Like, it's a different world today than it was 5-7 years ago. And again, you see these managers and you just see a tone shift in the way that they care deeply about the retail investor in a much more respected way.
Yeah. So Sam, with traditional 60-40 portfolios facing challenges, you know, bonds struggling with inflation and equities experiencing volatility, that seems to be, you know, an ongoing, that's like a never ending challenge, right? But we have some, you know, we have some economic concerns and questions, of course. How do you see private assets fitting into a portfolio construction today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important question. I mean, there's generic ways to think about it, and then there's precise ways. But ultimately, the starting point would be, you know, I would always look at what's my liquidity needs as an investor,
right,
you know, over the next 12, 24, 36 months. And like, you know, 5 years from now, like, am I going to buy a house? Am I going to, you know, fund my kids' tuition for university? Like, what amount of capital do I need? That is ultimately, I don't know. I want to make sure that I never have to basically be stuck. I can't get access to it. And so let's say I like, that's 30% of my portfolio or 40% of my portfolio at any point is at risk of needing liquidity. Well, that's really, you know, you got to put that aside. You got to make sure that that's, you know, managed properly and all the rest of it into the time frame that's needed. What you're dealing with then is the rest of the portfolio, and you say, okay, what do I want? And to me, it's all about, one, do I find good assets to buy?
Right.
Like, I would not be just allocating to privates because it's like du jour. I would allocate because I find a really great strategy, a great manager that I feel from a long-term perspective gives me the kinds of exposures that I want. And of course, there's three areas that retail generally, you know, looks at, and I'd say private equity, private credit, and private real estate. In Canada, private real estate has become, of course, a big part of most people's perspective when they think of assets and private assets. And even in, you know, when you think about it, most of the private credit strategies that are in Canada are effectively credit to real estate. So, you know, most investors today are over-indexed to real estate as a component. And my view is that real estate is good. I mean, you know, of course, it has been challenges depending on where you are. But, you know, private equity and private credit are the two really unique and exciting areas. Canada, private credit to me is a really important one that has structural changes in it that, in my opinion, have a big need for private credit to be a larger part of the capital markets and all the rest of it. And private equity is just a unique asset that there's a lot of structural things that private equity investors will do to generate returns that are different than public markets. So, you know, my general view is that most investors can at least tolerate 10% of their portfolio in illiquid assets. And then, you know, some investors could be up to 20%. So you might, you know, and because it's credit, real estate, and equity, you want to basically take that from each of the buckets, whether it be the equity bucket and the credit, your fixed income bucket, and as opposed to just all from equity per se.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about private equity because, you know, it has so many associations and connotations with it, that term. And, you know, but now, you know, with having had more awareness and more education about what exactly private equity is, it feels to me like it's what I always wanted to be able to offer my clients as an advisor. It feels like something I always hoped I could have the chance to do, to invest that way. When you start talking about discounted cash flows and this is how you value a business, and you start to, you know, reflect on the idea that Warren Buffett put forward a long time ago, which was that, you know, if the stock market was to close for 10 years, what would you want to own? And you'd want to own strong businesses with wide, you know, with good moats, you know, predictable future growth and cash flows that you can value. You want to have a hand in managing those businesses. Those are all the, you know, I mean, maybe I'm not providing all the check boxes that private equity ticks off when it's done right.
But
it does tick off all those boxes. And we, you know, we look at markets. I mean, investing would be great if we didn't have to deal with all the volatility that we actually do have to deal with. We invest in the stock market for the volatility premium. Instead, with private equity, what we're actually doing is we're trading liquidity for that premium as well, right?
If you think about capital, when you're an investor in public markets, unless you're a major, you know, owner of the stock,
right,
like you own 10-20% of the company, you're really a commodity. You're just a commodity of capital. Like, the company is doing what it's doing. You are a one shareholder of many, and your capital is just sitting there, and you make a choice of either I'm in the company or I'm out. Okay. But you have no influence, you have your role. Your job is just you're a commodity of capital.
Right.
If you get into private equity, there's an opportunity to take the commodity of capital, which capital can be a commodity in many ways, and turn it into also a value add. And, you know, this idea of, like, you know, someone who deploys capital, but also is involved in setting course, working with management, supporting them in, you know, the decisions they're making, looking at capital structure, all the things that really matter. And theoretically, you know, the question you have to, you know, say is, if someone who is very good at doing those things can apply that extra value add above the commodity of the asset of the capital,
right,
can they add value? And if they do, then that's great. By the way, there are good people at that, and there are bad people, Zach. So just buying private equity doesn't mean you're going to do well.
No.
There are good executives, just like in the stock market, for good at employing commodity capital, and there are those who are bad at it. And so what's really important is, you know, picking people who have a track record of doing it well, like adding value above the capital itself. But just to level set it, when you are a stock investor, you are a commodity. Your capital is alongside of a lot of other people. You have zero influence. The only thing you can do is to sell or buy, and that's the only influence you have. Beyond that, you have a very limited role. I mean, even the voting and things like that, it's very limited, because ultimately it's all the size of the whole group. So my real comment is, private capital allows for that exercise of value add above the commodity of capital. And if you give people that ability to exercise that, can they add value? And that's really what you're underwriting and you're paying for. I mean,
right,
you know, there's fees associated. I mean, I can buy an index fund for 10 basis points, but private capital generally comes with, you know, fees of 1% or so plus a performance of value add. And, you know, that to me is, you're paying for that value add. That's ultimately what it comes down to. But if they do it, then it can be really a great outcome net of fees.
But I think in today's, you know, commoditization of fees, paying that fee is an indication of the value that's being added. It's in proportion.
Yes and no. I mean,
it might not be.
To be honest, like, there are a lot of people out there who just leverage the fee structure to basically, you know, earn a lot of fees for themselves without actually adding the value.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, you know, what you really want to focus in, and what when you get into, when you look at public market investing, you know, track records can come and go, right? It's based on your structure and your trend, your history and things of that to some degree. There is a correlation between long-term track record and short-term, you know, performance of going forward to some degree. But in privates, it's actually much more aligned. And what I mean by that is, if you're really good at it, you generally tend to stay at the top, you know, of the quartile stack. If you're bad at it, you tend to be bad at it. And so, you know, I think it is coming down to, you know, picking the right manager comes down to those who've got a track record. It doesn't mean that they always perform, because they are in, you know, periods of returns. Like, so your period of investing could be just like if you bought the stock market through a period of a flat environment, whatever it be, you might be unhappy with a company or the performance of a manager, you know, that manages your portfolio. But like, in private assets, the same thing. But over time, good managers tend to have more regular positive track records in private equity.
How do you see private equity, private credit, and real estate potentially enhancing returns, reducing risk, but also providing uncorrelated income streams?
I would say that there's a lot of different strategies in each of these. So it's not, and I want to be level set again, like, it's not guaranteed that, in my opinion, the private equity, private credit, and all these things outperform
right.
buying, you know, just liquid assets. What the difference is that more often than not, you get to compound those returns for a longer period of time. And, you know, so if I buy a stock market, I may, you know, trade it, I might do things or whatever, and that may ultimately, you know, create friction.
Right.
Whereas with private assets, generally I compound those returns for longer because I'm locked into it. The things that are in private equity that are not, I mean, public companies can do these things and they do them. They're just more, you know, it's more difficult because they have more patience in private equity, meaning like you're not worrying about what the market needs me to perform in the next quarter
right.
for my quarterly reporting. You're worrying about what's the strategy to win over the next 3 to 5 years? And let's execute that. And that might mean a couple of lean years of performance and growth to get to really great outcomes. Like if, for example, a company that has to go private to restructure itself, invest in technology, to do something to win against some competitive change. So those things in the public markets are much more harder, and private markets is much easier. But ultimately, there's different tools in private equity. So the first one is like leverage. There's capital restructuring. There is the kind of, you know, changes in investments and R&D and things like that you want to make. There's management turnover that you can ultimately execute. There's efficiencies in operating model
right.
and the rest of it. There's a lot of things that can happen in private equity. And that's a huge opportunity. And that can generate, you know, generally outsized returns if you do it right. The second way in private equity is being an investor in secondary. So, you know, other people buy private equity and, you know, they don't have the same, they have liquidity. They thought that they had 10 years to invest in it. And frankly, you know, something happens and they need to sell earlier. So they're willing to sell their positions at a discount, and you can come in later and buy it from them at a discount. Secondaries are a really great
right.
thing, especially for retail, because you're buying things generally that, you know, right away you're buying it at a discount to its fair value. And you know, your return streams might be different, but ultimately it could be shorter term as well. And so there's a whole bunch of things in private equity that's like that. And the returns can be really great depending on if you have a right mix of those things and in the portfolio. In my opinion, most retail investors should be allocating to series of those things. A manager that can do primary, really good structuring, leverage buyouts, change of direction of a business, plus secondaries, all those things embedded into one portfolio. On the credit side, the big thing that really is structurally changing on credit is that the banks are reducing their capital on a broad basis, and they're saving it for their most important customers.
Right, right.
The banks are bigger, of course, so they have lots of capital. And of course, that's changing with all the regulatory changes around capital requirements. But they're, at a minimum, they're changing their stance to say, I'm saving this capital for my biggest and best customers. And those are the big liquid companies that need it, the ones who do lots of business, M&A, you know, fees to the banks. And that means that every other, you know, client,
right.
every other business is getting access to less and less capital from the banks. And so, you know, that's where private credit becomes really, really important. But more importantly, I would say the banks are actually not best suited for long-term lending. And the reason is because banks, remember, are built on short-term deposits,
right.
retail deposits that could go tomorrow, right? And so they're actually, their lending terms are generally going to be shorter in nature, meaning that they could pull the loan any day, right? Whereas private capital, because it's private credit, because you are, you know, investing in the long run, you have more lockups of the capital, they can take longer terms. And so companies prefer and will pay a premium for terms that say, I have this money for 5 years,
right?
And you can't take it away from me. And as a result of that, you know, they'll pay a premium for that. And so that's where private credit really adds a lot of value. Is not only is it in a segment of customers that are not getting the attention of the banks, but more importantly, they also can compete with the banks because their terms can be better from a structural perspective for the company at a moment in time relative to the bank. And that's a powerful value add. And
yeah.
I see private credit actually an area where you can really do better than the public markets in a meaningful way in the long run.
It's very enticing. I mean, to think that you know, not only as a borrower, as a corporate borrower, that you could set very favorable terms that favor you, as opposed to, you know, having this looming uncertainty of you know, your loans or your credit being pulled at any moment because of the bank's liquidity. But as an investor, you can see where, you know, that trade-off is very enticing as well, as being able to be involved in that kind of lending where you are the recipient of the higher yield. I mean, that's very enticing. And given that there's this big lending gap that continues to widen, I mean, the field of opportunity is also widening very rapidly as well. I mean, like, you know, with the stricter lending conditions at all banks, you know, there's all these pressures that are happening that are causing all these unintended consequences, right?
They work together. I mean, they're like, look, the private capital is filling a gap that the banks don't want to fill anymore. And they're working together to support customers that need more flexibility and structuring and the banks ultimately aren't best suited for. And so I actually think it's a really important formation of a great and healthy capital markets and call it structural environment, right, or companies to win with. And look, private credit will do a different type of research, a certain amount of depth into the businesses. They may actually have influence on the company, you know, have a board seat, whatever it be, depending on it. Whereas banks, of course, would never do any of that stuff. So there's that value add opportunity that can come with it too. And, you know, they can also be there if let's say the company wants to buy something, they could be right there beside them, supporting them through that acquisition. And so there's a whole bunch of things that private credit can do, like private equity. And actually, you're finding the convergence of private equity and private credit in a meaningful way, where players like Apollo today do both. And actually, more often than not, will invest in both the capital of the debt and the equity of a company more and more. Whereas, you know, those have generally been historically, you know, divorced. And I think that that's a really powerful thing. These companies are getting more aligned and saying, we want to own the whole capital structure of a business, not just one sleeve of it.
And it lends itself to much more efficient management, right? So,
yeah, I mean, companies have to think deeply about, you know, if I have someone on my equity and debt, what's the conflicts of that? But ultimately, it gives the companies a lot of flexibility in how they work with different players.
Yeah. So we've talked about liquidity and illiquidity. We've touched on the illiquidity, the idea of having an illiquidity bucket in advance of making these decisions to allocate to private markets. That remains really like one of the biggest concerns among investors, is the liquidity question, right? With institutions and sophisticated investors who have, you know, accepted the illiquidity in return for better returns. How do you walk us through why private assets, how are you structuring liquidity in order to make your offerings of private equity, private credit, private real estate more attractive to individual investors? Like, what are the terms that investors can expect from you?
So first, I just want to correct one thing that you said. I really am sensitive to this point that private capital or private equity can outperform and will give better returns because of illiquidity. I actually think that's a really, there's lots of moments when that isn't correct. And so we just have to be careful, because I believe that investors should buy this not because they think they're going to get a big outperformance versus buying the NASDAQ or the S&P 500, but because it has a different set of outcomes and a different set of, call it, return streams that can come from it. They can result in outperformance. But, you know, if you're an Apple investor, you're pretty hard to outperform Apple investing. And so, like, or NVIDIA or any of these companies. Yeah. So, like, I just want to be very careful. You know, a lot of managers will come out and say that, like, oh, we're going to outperform. And, like, you know, it actually hasn't been proven that, for example, in venture funds have, for the most part, underperformed the NASDAQ. Right. But that doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's different. And you just have to think about it in a different way.
Is a better way of thinking about it than not necessarily in terms of nominal outperformance, but risk-adjusted returns?
No.
Not even this?
You know, no, because I've heard this argument many times here. Sorry. Oh, my private equity fund has less risk than my stock market.
Yeah.
And just like my home has less risk than a REIT. That's not true. It's just that I don't market every day. So
yeah,
theoretically, they might show a lower volatility, but that's because you don't have price volatility every day. If you price a private equity portfolio every single day, because remember, when a company buys a company to go private, they're buying it from the public markets. Then when they buy it and they sell it, they IPO it into the public markets. The time in between, they decide what the value is. But at the end of the day, like, the liquidity is going to come from the public markets in many ways, or from a sale to another company that's in the public markets, whatever it be. And so I just find it like really, it's sort of an untruth to basically talk about, you know, it as a better risk adjusted return. It can be. It doesn't mean that it's guaranteed to be. All I'm trying to say to investors is don't buy it for that reason. Buy it because you fundamentally like the return streams and profile that fits into my portfolio. And I believe that for many investors, that's an important thing. But it can lead to greater outcomes. But oftentimes, what matters most is I am very comfortable that I've invested alongside of a great manager that has given me access to a unique return stream that I couldn't get in the returns in the public markets. And I am locked in a good way, such that over many years, I'm not going to have to worry about touching that and trading around it. I'm going to get the patience of that outcome because my capital is not just a commodity, it's able to add value in the names that it's invested into. So,
well, I appreciate that, Sam. I think everybody will appreciate that comment because, you know, expectations are everything, right? I mean, when it comes down to why people invest, if the expectations are set wrong, you know, you're asking for disappointment. Exactly. Yeah. You're inviting it.
But it also goes back to the trade-off question, which is a lot of people will say, well, I'm fine. I'm doing really well in the public markets. And that's not the reason. Like, you're not making this as a trade-off decision of should I buy the S&P 500 or should I buy, you know, private equity fund. It is really because I think that the two together actually outperform in the long run because I've made a better decision in my portfolio. So that's all it is. And as opposed to, yeah, like, there's an argument to say that the CPP should have been 100% long the stock market over the last, you know, 10, 20 years. And in fact, probably would have done better than just all the investments they've done. But the reality is that they have more control over their return streams because of it. Whereas when I buy the S&P 500, I have no idea what the market's going to give me next year. I have no idea what it's going to give me over 3-5 years. I'm, again, directionally believing I'm buying good companies. But at the end of the day, I have no control over it. Whereas when you have private assets, you have more control over the return streams in many ways. I want to answer your question about liquidity structuring. So this is a really important point. I go back to, like, this isn't a perfect science. Like, you've got an illiquid asset. You've got generally liquidity. In a normal institutional world, call it drawdown funds, you would have put in the money. They make the allocations and you are locked in for 10, 12 years, theoretically, in the fund. And, you know, if you want to get liquidity, you have to sell it in a secondary that could be, as I said earlier, the discount. What with the evergreen structure, what's happened, and by the way, those don't really work well for retail. And I don't think that they work well for most, even high net worth and family offices. They're not good structures because most people don't like to have unproductive assets.
Right.
And there's a mismatch between my IRR and the firm's IRR. When I look at evergreen, so what's happened is they created these pools, they're called, you know, feeder funds or pools that will own the assets directly in a thing that is structured. And in those funds, they will create a set of different allocations. So it's not just I own 10 private companies or 10 private credit assets. They will own like a whole broad portfolio, some of which is paying distributions. Like if I'm a credit fund, it'll be constantly paying their, you know, quarterly or monthly dividends, income from the bonds. So that's new capital being recycled back in. There's capital that's being paid back because the bonds are maturing. In the case of private equity, there's companies that are, you know, early investments, later stage investments that are, you know, maybe being sold. And that money's kind of recycling back into the portfolio. Second is they might have things in the private equity space that have, you know, call it secondaries, other things that are shorter duration. And then they may even have, in some cases, some public assets, like, you know, assets that they've maybe sold or gone public with that have public exposure. And that might give some liquidity too. And the idea is that these portfolios have a directionally really great exposure, but have more redemption ability to them. So what the funds will do is they will create a redeemability, maybe a quarterly redemption, but with notice. So you'll have to give them 30 days or 60 days or 90 days notice so that they know and they can manage their liquidity need over a, you know, 3 to 6 month period. Second is they will have gates on them, meaning that they will say, okay, you can redeem, but maximum of 5% of the fund can be redeemed in any quarter.
Right.
So if everyone came and redeemed at the same time, 5% could be redeemed. But if you were redeeming in a quarter and you were the only person, you're likely going to be able to redeem. And the reality is that they've structured these things very methodically to allow for both the portfolio to have liquidity, you know, coming and going, and you know, the structure so that it has, call it a spigot, but that spigot is kind of managed in a way, right? And that's the kind of stuff that private capital funds are doing more now that in the past they were doing poorly. I would say that we've seen some Canadian situations, and even in America, we've seen the situation where, you know, a public company, a retail-like fund was created on a private asset, and then redemptions were asked, and they didn't do a great job of managing the portfolio or the gating structures, and it actually led to them having to close the redemptions for everybody and actually cause a liquidity crisis. In those scenarios, that's just poor management, poor structuring. But I think they're doing a better job today of being methodical around this and you know, creating the right gates in their redemption models, but also have the right structure to the portfolio allocations.
What have you done at Purpose in your platform to break down the barriers to make private markets more accessible?
Yeah, so first and foremost, what we've tried to do is really focus on three things. One, we have partnered with the best managers. So we have three funds that they're right now in private equity. We partner with Pantheon, who has a phenomenal long-term track record of, you know, private equity across a number of different segments and in a wonderful evergreen fund. Two is we partner with Apollo on the private credit side. Again, a wonderful manager that has a great track record in an evergreen structure. And then three, we partnered with BlueRock, one of the, you know, really amazing real estate managers. That is, you know, most people don't know them, but they're just unbelievable in the real estate space. And what we did was, so that's the first thing we did. The second thing we said was we need to create really great transparency around education and awareness and understanding of what it means to invest not only in these managers, but in these asset categories. So we created an educational structure that really allows an advisor to go in and do educational work, learning from both the structure and the strategy and the manager through videos and other things like that, that actually give them a lot of confidence on their KYP, their know your product, know your manager, things like that. And then the third is we've created a bunch of structuring things around access. So lower minimums, our minimums are $5,000 for, you know, our private equity and real estate and $2,500 for our private credit. So we don't, even though it's accredited investors only, we've created a minimum that allows you to allocate in smaller accounts, but also across the portfolio in a different way. We have evergreens and everything we're doing with quarterly liquidity. And then I think what's really important is that I think these products are really, really high quality exposures that investors know that, you know, I'm not going to get, sorry to use this word, screwed by the manager decision.
Right.
Like, I'm not buying something that's going to blow up. Like, Apollo's reputation, Pantheon's, BlueRock's reputation matter more than anything else. And so they're not going to screw around with that. And so we've partnered with, you know, that kind of caliber and gives the confidence that you're really focusing on the return streams rather than did I make a bad decision on the manager diligence part?
Yeah, I mean, those are stellar names in the field. That's a really big hurdle to overcome at the outset. How do you think advisors should be thinking about these assets for their clients? Like, what I know you're going to be, you know, you're going to work with advisors very closely in order to get them up to speed. You know, that it's a fairly decent length on ramp to get up and running. The accessibility is wonderful. I think the fact that you can start at such palatable minimums to begin to introduce these assets into a core portfolio model makes it actually quite exciting. You're not faced with, you know, big allocation decisions. You can decide to piecemeal them over time if you like, and make it a very gradual process for advisors. But where do you see the best approach for advisors when it comes to getting their clients on board with private markets, with private assets?
Well, I think the first thing is that let's not fall into the historical perspective that private assets are risky. Like, just because I'm using an offering memorandum, it's for accredited investors, you know, all these, call it, you know, things that people feel I'm going into a riskier component. We make it so hard. My view is that it's not true, and private isn't risky and public isn't safe. It's actually about the quality of what ultimately you're buying and the returns and the managers and this and that altogether. So I think that that's a first and foremost thing. Second thing is I do think that it's important to understand deeply, you know, why am I buying it? Like, private equity, private credit. First off, private equity has many different forms to it. Private credit has many different forms to it. Real estate has many different forms to it. Like, you know, understanding the quality and the return goals of the strategy, what it's trying to do, really doing the diligence on that is really important. And then three is that, like, really sit down and understand, like, what is the liquidity requirement that my customers actually have? And what do I have the capacity to use private assets for? I think, like I said, most people over-index to liquidity, and that actually is probably not necessary. And I think there's an opportunity to use private assets more as a component of the portfolio construction as opposed to just a, hey, I went off, I did this cool trade, I got access to this great exposure, but rather a structural long-term asset mix allocation that can be really cool. So,
yeah. So, I mean, it's about making a strategic decision to improve or increase the breadth of asset types in the portfolio. Saum, thank you so much for your time, first of all, your incredibly valuable time, and for your insight. I think there's a lot to think about in our conversation today. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Pierre. It's an important topic. I'm glad you're spending some time on it, and I hope investors really dig in and understand that, like, we're probably under invested in privates in our portfolios. And I actually think that, I know a lot of people talk about that, but I actually do think that most investors can really benefit from thinking more deeply about this, and try to avoid all the, you know, historical views of what you've thought is private assets. And, you know, I still see people saying, oh, I've got privates. I would just urge you to, you know, there's better out there now. Like, Canada, we don't need to rely on what we used to. Like, if it worked out for you, great. But today, I think we are in a much better position for Canadian investors to have access to excellent, excellent stuff.
Thank you, Saum.